Bet the board.
What do you mean you don't bet?
I mean, I don't bet. You know, I don't care. I don't. I never have, and I never will.
Yeah, right.
I'll bet you $20 I can get you gambling before the end of the day.
You owe me $15,000, pal.
Pay him. Pay that man his money.
It's the Bet the Board podcast.
God likes me. He really, really likes me.
In the end, I wound up right back where I started. I could still pick winners, and I could still make money for all kinds of people back home. And why mess up a good thing?
Here's Payne Insider and Todd Furman.
Welcome into the Bet the Board podcast, NFL Week 14, a Monday Night Football edition. It's time of the year where rubber meets the road. You start to separate the pretenders from the contenders, and we had plenty of very interesting results already unfold this weekend. I am your host, Todd Furman, joined, as always, by my esteemed colleague and co-host, the one, the only, Payne Insider. And Payne, after spending 90 minutes deliberating our best bet last Thursday or thereabouts, apparently we could have gone in a variety of different directions with the exact same result.
I don't know what you're talking about. Let's move on.
What did you make?
I don't think anyone has a clue, right? It's like one of those things that at least guys who bet real money that have crossed over and create some content will understand. But for those that just listen, we could have five figures on a game. We could have six figures on a game as a group, and it's the fucking best bet that we're out here sweating. The rest of the stuff is just becomes irrelevant. Like, it just, it is what it is. We become immune to it. It's our money. It's not a problem. But the best bet that, who knows, right? We give it out on a Thursday morning. By the time Sunday comes around, information changes. You might have more money on a different game. It just, it's not the focal point at that point. It's just the stupid best bet on the podcast. So,
yeah, it's a pretty wild process, like you said, for those folks that create content, a hell of a lot different than when you're betting your own money. And it's the same thing if you're sharing information with, you know, friends or family. You could care less if your bet wins or loses. You know, over the course of the full season, you're going to end up in the right spot. It's more annoying to deal with some of the incessant back and forth and the second guessing that comes along with it. But I feel like that's a perfect place for us to start on a Monday. As we always do, we kick things off with the good, the bad, and the ugly. We'll talk look ahead lines and some adjustments that we've seen in the market. The good doc Deepak stops by to talk about injury updates, and it felt like every second tier quarterback dealt with a concussion already during week 14. And last but certainly not least, a preview of Monday Night Football between the Cardinals and Patriots. I guess, Payne, what we saw last Sunday Night Football, Chargers Dolphins total gets steamed up from 51.5 all the way out to 55, a little bit of buyback there on the under. You see some money come in on the dog, the 3.5s largely disappear. That game closes 3, and Tua goes out there and puts forth the worst half we've seen from a starting quarterback in the 2022 season from a completion percentage, completing just 20% of his passes, and that game was as ugly as it looked the first 30 minutes.
Such a weird game, because I think we talked a little bit on Thursday where we thought things would head and where there were potential value, and said, hey, you know, if the Chargers somehow got to 4, we'd be intrigued there, even though there was initial sharp money on Miami. Never got there, even with the injuries to Derwin James and Bryce Callahan and Sebastian Joseph Day. Like, none of those guys ended up playing, and that's ultimately why the total shot from 51.5 out to as high as 55, and just one of those games in the market that we've talked about being a weird season, Todd, because our model showed value to the under. We were trying to make a case for it at 53. Someone did and shot it down to like 51.5, and then when all the injuries transpired, we just saw a massive wave of over money. It wasn't close. In terms of Tua, I think Mike McDaniel deserves some of the blame as well. And I know we had discussed this at ad nauseum, right? Like, through 12 weeks, Tua and Mike McDaniel should have been everyone's favorite for MVP and coach of the year. And that's just how good it was going. But the schedule was going to get extremely difficult to close the season. And we said this would be when we figure out what Miami really is. And we didn't really love the trade for Bradley Chubb. I understood it, but I didn't think Miami was a piece away. And you can clearly see some of the holes that the Dolphins have, and they're massive. And I'm not sure they get fixed, especially on a short week back across the country and what appears to be a wintry environment in Buffalo. But you look at Tua, obviously he was miserable. I think there's been some concerning things Mike McDaniel said the last 2 weeks about Tua, if you've paid close enough attention. And I didn't really love any of the game plan. I didn't really like any of the adjustments. There just had to be more underneath stuff in the throw game. Everything was like a video game deep pass. And if you look, Tua averaged more than 12 intended air yards per pass attempt. It was the most of any quarterback last week. Finished 24th out of 26th in EPA per play. So he's throwing the furthest, which has the potential for more expected points, but he was that bad. And worst completion percentage over expectation, nearly 16% below expectation. It was bad all around. I mean, Brandon Staley flat out pencil whipped Mike McDaniel yesterday. So give Brandon Staley and that staff some credit. I know they've come under heat in the last month or so.
Yeah, and suddenly a Chargers team, despite a depleted roster, 7-6. We'll see if they're able to keep a little of that momentum going forward and be able to crash the back half of the AFC playoff picture. As far as some of the other good that we saw, Payne, in this game, you could spin it one of two ways, and I think it bears mentioning on both sides of the ball. Going back to Thursday night, full marks to Baker Mayfield, was in LA for about 48 hours, leads one of the more improbable comebacks of the season, completed 15 of his 20 passes in the fourth quarter, flawlessly directing his new teammates downfield for two scores. What I found entertaining as hell is he still said he had some beef with Van Jefferson, but at least that late touchdown allowed them to bury the hatchet because Van ghosted him on a potential recruiting trip back in the day before Jefferson ended up at Florida when Baker was trying to bring him to Oklahoma. But full credit to the Rams for erasing a 16-3 deficit, not just covering that number as nearly a touchdown underdog, but finding a way to win outright and most likely dashing any sliver of hope that the Raiders had of getting into the AFC playoff picture.
Baker had a couple nice throws in the first half, but there wasn't any down-to-down consistency. And even in the third quarter when the Rams were pushing for points, they came away with zip on that drive that could have set up a first and 10 from inside the Raider 15. But specifically to Baker, he wasn't very good the first three quarters. 31% passing success rate, that was the second worst mark of the week. His completion percentage was 24% below expectation the first three quarters. But to your point, flipped the switch in the fourth quarter. Positive 0.27 EPA per play, completion percentage 15% over expectation in that final stanza. And that's kind of his vibe. When there's like no pressure and he can go out and be the underdog when all the odds are stacked against him, he seems to play a little bit better. We heard Baker talk about being in shock at some of the looks he was being given, specifically that touchdown to Van Jefferson. So maybe some coaching malpractice from the Raiders defensive coordinator, Patrick Graham, there. But this just wasn't Baker. The offensive line was really good, and that's a unit that regressed big time. Still not 100% there, but you'll get Baker pressured on less than 22% of his dropbacks. And then the holes that were created in the ground game for Akers and Kyren Williams, Rams ended with a 50% success rate on the ground. They could have had more points had Akers not fumbled in the first half, had that ridiculous penalty not been called, you know, in the third quarter there on, you know, love tap 6 yards behind the actual play. So no doubt storybook ending for Baker. That was fantastic. But the Rams O-line deserves some credit. Baker, in typical Baker fashion, seen at the nightclub celebrating just hours after this performance.
You got to try and reap the benefits for those 15 minutes of fame. We'll see how long he's able to keep a stranglehold on that job. I would say the remainder of the regular season, as the Rams will try and figure out if Matthew Stafford has his imminent return in 2023. What other good things stood out from what you've seen so far in this weekend of football?
Well, let's go to the game that we broke down pretty extensively. Lions, Jared Goff. I mean, that turnaround mid-season, amazing. Just nothing short of fantastic. And you look at Goff, the perception has changed a little bit on him. And when you start to hear what's coming out of Detroit, that he's their quarterback, they're not going to look for one early on in the draft. And you start to think about the money making some sense. He'll be outside the top 10 in salary. It appears like Jared Goff's going to be the Lions quarterback for at least the near future. But we talked specifically about his splits indoors at Ford Field. They'd been really dramatic. And then you go out this week and it bears fruit. I mean, the Lions passing offense, best of the week, positive 0.22 EPA per drop back. The Lions were actually really aggressive at some key points there. I know we shot text back and forth when it felt like momentum was slipping a little bit. Just Dan Campbell came out with the brass balls and had the fake punt and completely swung the vibe back.
What a play call there with your season hanging in the balance, knowing the things that turned against you.
And then defensively, the Lions at least shut down one aspect of the Vikings offense. Minnesota, 11% rushing success rate, average negative 0.57 EPA per rush. Both marks the worst of week 14. So you had one element of the Lions defense shutting down the Vikings. I know Kirk Cousins looked damn good. He actually played quite well. But the Lions offense carried the day. And ultimately, I thought at halftime, probably could have been a little bit larger of a lead than seven, but in the second half came out refocused and built that double digit lead. And really, Minnesota didn't feel like they were close in that second half.
You mentioned the defense for the Lions and specifically what they were able to do on the ground. Dalvin Cook's 1.5 yard per carry average was the lowest in a game where he carried the ball at least 10 times in his 6-year career. So making teams one dimensional, even if that one dimension is outstanding, as it was with Kirk Cousins to Justin Jefferson, who had arguably the quietest 200-plus yard receiving day of the entire season. Full marks to Detroit, avenging an earlier season loss, and you've seen their odds to make the playoffs dip up from all the way from 9-1 a couple of short weeks ago, now to right around 3-1. We'll see if the Lions can continue that momentum this week as they head to New York, playing outside against that very tenacious Jets defense. Talk about quarterbacks performing well, getting the best of some of their weapons. I think Trevor Lawrence deserves a ton of credit there as well, Payne. And we're starting to finally see flashes, maybe not consistently enough for the number one overall pick in the draft, but at least to lead us to believe that Doug Peterson is having a positive impact and that this is a team that has a little bit of optimism. Now, it does come with the caveat that the Tennessee Titans had about 17 secondary players out. They were down about 13 linebackers as well, but it shouldn't discourage anyone from throwing cold water on Evan Ingram's performance. 11 catches, 162 yards, and a pair of touchdowns. That puts him in rarefied air as far as tight end productivity is concerned. Zay Jones had a big day, and they did this all without the services of a ground game, because we know the Titans take away any team that wants to run the ball first and foremost.
Yeah, I mean, listen, you're going to win a lot of games when you're plus four in turnovers, and your young team is searching for confidence after getting their ass kicked the week prior. And if you look at that game, those weren't your garden variety turnovers. They happened in the scoring areas. But you absolutely give the Jags credit here. I mean, they had the right game plan. Doug Peterson came out throwing, and you hit it perfectly. This is a Titans defense that was decimated by injury at linebacker and in the secondary. And you look even last week. I mean, we know the Titans stopped the run extremely well. Doug Peterson's old team gave him the blueprint. We saw this exactly perfected from Philly's offense a week ago, where you just come out, you pass, you attack the weakness. Evan Ingram, 15 targets. The Titans' backup linebackers did not have a prayer against him. If you watch that game, they're just routinely getting lost on crossers and drag routes. I mean, Peterson just put those linebackers in conflict all day.
It felt like Ohio State Michigan for all those years in the rivalry. You just put athletes out in space and you realize they're going to get 6 yards of separation.
And to your point specifically about Trevor Lawrence, I mean, he finished quarterback 5 in EPA plus completion percentage over expectation. This is one of the larger steam positions of the week. Titans peaked at 4.5, closed soft 3 at some of the sharp shops. But to your point, when you look at Trevor Lawrence, the one thing that he is doing, even when they aren't playing to where we think they should, or Trevor Lawrence still hasn't completely turn the corner and delivering consistent performances week in and week out, the one thing he has done has not turned the ball over, right? I mean, you're looking the last 5 games with 0 interceptions. So he's at least taking care of the ball. And we hadn't really seen that, at least through some of the games earlier on this year.
No, and it's such an important skill. Look, if you're not going to create short fields for your opponent, they don't have the opportunity to capitalize there. Instead, it was the role reversal where Jacksonville, to your point, was able to create those short fields, went out there, scored 26 unanswered points at one juncture of the game, and ended a long, long losing streak in the Music City. As far as San Francisco, Payne, I'm not sure who to give the game ball to. If it goes to Kyle Shanahan and everything that they devised offensively, or Brock Purdy going out there to execute. But you look at the 49ers, who lose yet another difference maker, a little bit more optimism about Deebo Samuel's potential return if it is indeed a high ankle sprain instead of a torn ACL or something worse like a lot of us feared watching that game. Purdy finishes with a very good EPA, did what was asked of him there, but Christian McCaffrey finally showed flashes of being that game-breaking running back we know he could be, something that was mysteriously lacking over the last couple weeks.
Yeah, he was a little dinged up prior to the trade in terms of CMC. This game was wild because there was just a pretty large battle there. There was a lot of respected guys on the Buccaneers, and there were some guys that were coming in and laying the 49ers anytime it got to three. So a clear battle in that one. When I look at that, boy, the Bucs just kind of looked fatigued on defense. And that was one of the points that we made on the podcast, right? Like, you play Monday night, you exert a ton of energy and effort coming back, right? The final 3-4 minutes of that game. And now you're traveling across the country on a short week. And then, you know, you get Brock Purdy making some timely throws. I mean, that was what that game was about. But you look at Kyle Shanahan, who's able to get their ground game going, 52% rushing success rate, positive 0.15 EPA per rush. And then when Purdy was asked to pass, he was accurate. And I think the one element that at least bodes well moving forward is when Brock Purdy's pressured. He's done fantastic with the heat on. So maybe this isn't just a flash in the pan. Kyle Shanahan obviously invested that 7th round pick in him, didn't want Brock Purdy to become a priority free agent. So he removed that element from the equation, said, hey, this is a guy that I think has some attributes and some skill sets that I can work with. And I want to go and invest in him and make sure that we don't have a battle in the free agent market. So clearly saw something there. But even like the mobility right around the goal line was fantastic. And then you mentioned not like knowing who the game ball should go to, but quietly D'Amico Ryans. Yeah, I mean, just deserves a ton of credit there. I don't think he's going to be with San Francisco much longer. Someone's going to give him a crack at a head coaching job. But he employed like an interesting strategy defensively, but it was picture perfect. It's like he knew the Buccaneers weren't very efficient running it. He knew the Buccaneers loved running it on early downs, so he showed up in just a ton of light boxes and baited Tampa to run it. And if you look at Tampa's numbers, like, oh, they were able to run the ball pretty well. Well, sure, he allowed you to. But he made sure to just negate that quick, short pass game, and we know Tom loves to throw it quick and short. It was obvious with Tristan Wirfs down, the 49ers are probably going to be able to get some pressure. So D'Amico knew that they knew that they weren't going to be able to protect. So the ball was going to come out quick. And you could see it in the numbers on first and second down throws. Tampa was 21st out of 24 teams this week in drop back EPA. So D'Amico knew exactly what Byron Leftwich wanted to do. And it was get the ball out quick. And the 49ers had answers for it.
Storyline's already entertaining as people speculating what the Niners will do when Trey Lance returns from injury if Brock Purdy continues to play well for as long as he's the starting quarterback. We know Jimmy Garoppolo not long for there, but it makes me laugh with all of these quarterback controversies that happen after essentially 5.5 to 6 good quarters of football for a player that cost them a 7th round pick a few short years ago. Anything else in the good fashion that stood out to you for what you've seen so far?
We have to talk about it. Go to it. I know which one you want to talk about. I see it on your list. I think it deserves at least a golf clap, a mention for a team that was the largest underdog of the entire season.
I mean, yes, I agree. The Houston Texans deserve a little bit of praise for the effort that they put forth against the Dallas Cowboys. Doing so without their top two receiving options in Nico Collins and Brandon Cooks, Chris Moore steps into the number one role and shined. For Davis Mills, career highs, 10 catches, 124 yards. But what was a masterpiece and potentially pulling off the biggest upset that we've seen of the NFL season, it gets to be soured a little bit with a questionable play call that ends up lending itself to a 90-plus yard touchdown drive for the Dallas Cowboys to win 27-23. I'm not sure running the option on 4th and short with Jeff Driscoll would have been my path to pulling off that win and cementing victory, but hey, to each their own.
I actually, and I'm Mr. Aggressive, but I would have put the pressure on Dallas to score a touchdown. I would have kicked the field goal there, went up 6, and just put pressure on Dak. When I looked at this entire game, I think you give some kudos to the Texans staff. It starts with putting Davis Mills back under center. He is the best quarterback on the Texans roster, and by a lot. And then all of a sudden, you at least see some clear motivation angles in sight, right? I mean, this is a Texans team that doesn't have anything to play for at this point, but suddenly this is the game on the schedule where they see Big Brother, it's the Cowboys, and then you get the bulletin board material of being the largest underdog of the season. There's not much travel. There's little to no home field advantage, and so that's kind of how this plays out, but mostly Kellen Moore and Mike McCarthy didn't really have answers for the Texans defense, and you look at what Lovie Smith did, just went to his patented shell and the Cowboys passing offense wasn't very good. Dak only completed 6 balls for 10 yards or more. They just did a good job making Dak work and use that dink and dunk passing game and force him to be accurate, and he wasn't on some of those underneath throws. Finished with the second worst completion percentage over expectation of the week, 14% below expectation for Dak. Cowboys run game, something they rely on, sure. You know, you get the late touchdown from Zeke, but in totality, it was just a slightly above average run game. And when you compare it to what the Texans had been allowing, it comes in way below expectation. And then you look at Laremy Tunsil, who probably deserves the quiet game ball of the week. He was fantastic. I mean, he crushed Micah Parsons. They were one-on-one frequently, and Tunsil didn't allow a single pressure against the Cowboys. So he is quietly having quite the season in pass protection and really allowed Davis Mills to be quite comfortable most of the game.
Yeah, I mean, didn't see that coming. Houston having a chance to win outright. We know that when you're catching that many points in the NFL, the underdog is always intriguing. But what was interesting, earlier in the week, you actually saw Dallas catch a little bit of steam, taking that number out to 18. There, of course, was buyback as that number closed right around 17. With the
yes, as soon as it went. So there was initial move from 17 down to 16.5.
Yep.
And then, you know, 9,000 people pummeled the market at once, and it got to 18, and then some real professional money came in and took that back down to the close of 17.
With the good comes the bad, pain, and I'll let you kick things off in this particular section.
Where would you like to start? A game I know that was of the long debate was Seattle and Carolina, but we felt that number was burnt a little bit, so we didn't end up giving it out. Didn't matter. Carolina went box to wire there. Listen, I think when you look at the Seahawks' defensive performance, they had this little 4-game stretch that we've referenced a couple times now from weeks 6 through 9. But it was, you look at who they played, it was Arizona twice. It was the Giants in like a horrific situation who we knew would be downtrending, and there was weather. I mean, it just wasn't very many good offenses. It was the Chargers offense when they were going through their little lull. I mean, they really didn't get out of that lull until last night. So I didn't believe in the improvement that we had seen from Seattle's defense. And against Carolina, Seattle got bullied again in the trenches, allowed 56% of the Panthers' runs to grade successful. That was the third best mark of the week for the Panthers in their ground game. Seattle allowed the Panthers to average 0.27 EPA per rush. That was the second best mark of the week. Really didn't matter who it was either, right? Whether it was Foreman, who was dinged up a little bit and on the injury report this week, or it was Chuba. Seattle just has an inability to not get stops when it comes to the ground game, and that just allowed Carolina to control things. You know, they played it at their style, kept Seattle's offense on the sidelines. Now, it helps when you're +2 in turnovers, and the 2 turnovers turned into 10 points on just 38 yards. And it helps when Seattle's down to their 5th string running back, and it helps when Geno and DK Metcalf are on the injury report and didn't look themselves. But just a wildly disappointing effort from Seattle, and now all of a sudden, huge game on Thursday night against the 49ers that probably defines their season.
Yeah, you mentioned those two running backs, and it was even their third string running back, Raheem Blackshear, that has the back-breaking touchdown late in the game. A great job by Steve Wilks mixing those guys up, keeping the running backs fresh. And to talk about Seattle's run defense, when you just look at some of those counting stats, they don't blow you away at 4.5 yards per play for Carolina over the course of the full game. But when you run it 46 times to the tune of 223 yards on the heels of what Seattle has now allowed, 171 to the Rams the week before, 283 to Vegas the week before that, and 160 to a team that can't run the football in the Tampa Bay Buccaneers. No doubt red flags when you have to rinse, repeat, and recover against the division rival on a short week. And we know the 49ers will commit to the ground game, especially when they go on the road. I mean, that was the main thing I had in the bad. There were a number of things I could obviously group into the ugly. I know we talked about Tua earlier at the top. We talked about the Tampa Bay Buccaneers and what they didn't provide as far as a legitimate offensive threat and a defense that just looked gassed out there. So I wasn't sure if you had things that classified as bad before we pivoted ever so quickly to the ugly classification.
No. Let's head to the ugly, because I know you hinted at the top that we did break down Baker's performance, but maybe there was another side of the ball or another side of the coin that was potentially quite ugly in their performance, and that was your beloved Raiders.
Oh, the Raiders, they're not going to avoid the firing squad here. That is for damn sure, because yet again, they blow a commanding late lead, and for the fourth time this year, they drop a game where they led by 10-plus points. I mean, Derek Carr completes just 11 passes, only had 20 passing attempts, ended up targeting Devontae Adams 7 times to the tune of 3 catches, but I was surprised they didn't go in that direction a little bit more, even with Jalen Ramsey out there in coverage. They again completely bogged down in the second half, scoring a grand total of 3 points after the break, and a second half drive summary pain that was downright gruesome. 9 yards, 8 yards, 31 yards that resulted in a field goal after the Rams inexplicably attempt what felt like a 75-yard field goal for whatever reason. 9 yards, and then they get intercepted when they have a chance in the waning seconds of the game. All in all, they end up allowing the longest touchdown drive to win a game with under 2 minutes remaining in the last 45 years. Josh McDaniel took some of the responsibility, arguably should have taken all of it for his team's inability to execute and not showing the killer instinct. But it's amazing. If it happens once, it's an isolated incident. But when it continues to happen over and over and over and over again, there obviously should be heads that roll and fingers that need to get pointed throughout that Raiders locker room.
Yeah, I mean, you just have to put teams away, and the Raiders didn't do that. There was a ton of opportunity there to kind of get out and hide and, you know, give the Rams credit. They were certainly battled. They were undermanned on defense. All of the things that we discussed in that breakdown came to fruition where the Rams were able to show well against the run, especially when you exclude the end arounds. And then they did a fantastic job, at least early on, holding to 3 instead of giving up 7 when the Raiders entered the red zone. But the way things unfolded there just have to be better. The Raiders just can't get over the hump, but this isn't really the first time we've seen this. You know, they go through these massive lulls, and so I don't know what to expect here, because you just go through this and you look at their season in a nutshell, and it's like 3 points in the second half and overtime against the Cardinals. It's 0 points against the Saints. It's 0 points in the second half against the Jags. It's 0 points for the first 29 minutes against a Colts defense that was beaten and battered. It's 0 points, you know, the first 25 minutes against the Chargers. And then Thursday night, it's 6 points the final 47 minutes against the Rams. And that defense is in shambles, down arguably, you know, 3 of its top 4 defenders. So I don't really know what's going on there, but you just see these really massive peaks and valleys for this Raiders offense, and you can't figure it out. But I think we hit on it, right? Like, if you can kind of remove Devontae Adams and you can kind of slow down the run game, there's really not much else there. It does look like they'll have some weapons back potentially coming out of heading into the next game. So maybe Renfro is the jolt of energy the Raiders offense needs, but it looks like he's trending the right way for their next game.
Yeah, I mean, two players that represent more than 60% of their offensive yards. Obviously easier said than done to take away two guys that are that dynamic. But what was surprising to me as much as anything else, Josh Jacobs clearly had an issue with his finger, but that didn't stop the Raiders from not only letting him run the football, but throwing the ball to him as well. Just left me scratching my head when you had so many other opportunities, and they were creative early on. You mentioned some of those runs from the wide receiver to take advantage of a player for the Los Angeles Rams playing out of position, utilizing speed from Matt Collins, and you just didn't see any of that in the second half. And lo and behold, the Raiders find a way to invent another low when it comes to generating a loss. We saw a backup quarterback pain on display in Pittsburgh between the Steelers and the Ravens. Mitchell Trubisky's stat line, as far as completions, attempts, and yards, don't scream poor performance, but the turnovers ultimately did him in, and they obviously came at inopportune moments for Steelers fans, not so much for us with a Ravens team, with a Steelers team total under 19.5. The first interception for Trubisky occurred at the Ravens 10, second interception at the Ravens 8, third interception on a longer ball thrown downfield at the Ravens 1. But clearly, you can't win in the league against a good defense if you're going to turn the ball over countless times in plus territory.
Yeah, that feels like Mitchell Trubisky in a nutshell. You know, if you exclude the plays with turnovers, Trubisky was the number one quarterback in EPA plus completion percentage over expectation this week. But we know Trubisky struggles. He turns the ball over, isn't the best reading defenses. And I will say he kind of delivered a jolt of energy there to the offense. That was the last thing I wanted to see, because Kenny Pickett really looked pretty confused and stifled on his first few possessions, goes down with a concussion, and in comes Mitchell Trubisky, who's just a wildly different quarterback. And so I didn't love that. And you initially saw a couple drives there that were pretty good for Pittsburgh. In the second half, though, Baltimore was able to adjust at halftime to Mitchell Trubisky, and you kind of remove that last drive down two scores. There really wasn't a ton of things going Pittsburgh's way offensively in the second half, but those two drives prior to the half, certainly the turnovers played quite a large role there. The interception at the one was kind of an arm punt. It was a deep pass that was overthrown a little bit, but ultimately this is the knock on Trubisky. Just turns the ball over too much. Not the most competent of quarterbacks. I think we've hinted at that in the past. I would think he gets the start this week, right? Because now you're looking at the second concussion in about 5 weeks for Kenny Pickett. And so it wouldn't stun me if Mitchell Trubisky gets the start this week.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned the second concussion in about 5 weeks. An interesting situation unfolded there. Pickett leaves the game, comes back in the game. Who the hell knows what's going on the sidelines in this day and age. Anything else ugly-wise that you wanted to make sure we highlighted before we headed into some of the look-ahead lines?
We probably should have had it in the positive category, and I understand that they didn't win but did get the cover. And we can go one of two ways. I think Robert Saleh came out with another good defensive game plan. Certainly the weather helped aid things, but all things told, Buffalo Bills offensively, struggle city, dead last in EPA per play of all the teams that have played this week. You look at their inability to get the ground game going, just a 23% rushing success rate. You look at what they were doing through the air, and Diggs was pretty much shut down again. So I think when you look at some of the more disappointing, ugly performances of the week, I know you came away with a win, but Buffalo offensively with some question marks again, with the worst performance of the week in terms of EPA per play, which is pretty shocking when you think about the talent they have and you think about who's running that system. Now all of a sudden, you know, we look at some things. I know we're transitioning to look ahead lines, so I'm probably getting ahead of myself, but that's one of the games that has moved substantially. And from a total perspective, obviously some weather in play there against Miami, but two offenses that are downtrending just a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, an interesting game, like you said, two offenses not exactly clicking on all cylinders. You throw in a little bit of the elements and suddenly you have a very intriguing game come Saturday night from Orchard Park, New York. You can follow Payne on Twitter at Payne Insider. I'm Todd Furman. You can follow me there. More importantly than that, follow the podcast at Bet the Board Pod. And when you look at the look ahead numbers, Payne, you mentioned it and we'll get there in just a second. But let's start things on Thursday night where the 49ers were a pick'em on the look-ahead number. The Niners go out there and absolutely dust the Tampa Bay Buccaneers. The Seattle Seahawks get beaten box to wire by the Carolina Panthers, as you referenced earlier. And here we are with the 49ers, more than a field goal favorite, going on the road in the division on a short week.
I think you said everything perfectly. I mean, the question marks surrounding Brock Purdy have been answered to this point. Is the Seattle defense going to be the variety that gives San Francisco trouble, knowing that you can just kind of turn around and rely on the ground game? How much is Brock Purdy going to be needed in a game like this? We'll see. But I do think you have a lot of guys in this market that are higher on Seattle, and they'll probably wait to see how high this gets. We saw a couple flashes of four in the market this morning, and they'll allow that to continue to leak out. So I don't know where this heads, because I envision the public being all over the 49ers in this standalone game, and I think you might have some guys just kind of wait back and see the number they can get on Seattle. But in terms of the matchup, it's not a great one, and we just kind of talked about Geno and DK being a little bit beat up. Let's see how they respond in a short week.
Two games that have been on the move for Saturday. One is the game that you'll see in the middle of the day, 4:30 Eastern, between the Browns and Ravens. The Browns were 3.5-point favorites on the look-ahead number. Now we're looking at 2.5s painted across the board. Deshaun Watson struggles yet again. The Ravens not quite sure who they're going to have under center. And so many conflicting factors contributing to where this number sits right now.
You get two games for Deshaun Watson under his belt to be a little bit more comfortable first home game in an environment that he's at least a little bit more familiar with, has had some practice sessions. And so, huge game. I would say this is one where their season's on the line, but this is mostly movement due to Tyler Huntley, who left the game in the third quarter against Pittsburgh with a concussion. You're now in a short week, so we know how those have been treated. And ultimately, we could be in a situation where it's the former Duck and BC quarterback Anthony Brown under center for the Baltimore Ravens on Saturday.
Dolphins, Bills, the number hasn't really moved much. You're still looking at the Bills, a 7.5-point favorite. This number was 6.5 on a look ahead. The total, as you mentioned, has come down from a peak of, you know, 45, even some 47s that were out there. We're now looking at 42. I don't think this one bears much of a deep dive at all, so we may as well head into Sunday, where the Jets and the Lions. The Jets were a 3-point favorite playing host to the Detroit Lions on your look ahead number. Mike White taken to the hospital for precautionary reasons in the wake of their loss against the Buffalo Bills, and here we are now with the Jets and Lions at MetLife Stadium listed at pick 'em.
Yeah, let's see where this ultimately trends from here. I think a lot of it will be dependent on Mike White. I know Deepak will be talking about him shortly here in the injury segment, so I won't steal his thunder, but I think a lot of this has to do with the status of Mike White, but obviously the Detroit Lions trending in a right direction. The total this morning got whacked as well. I saw Chris open, you know, 47.5. We're now down to 44.5. Partly the quarterback situation, partly the Lions outside of the dome, and those are the two factors there. But we've seen substantial movement both side and total.
Favorite flip in Charlotte, where the Pittsburgh Steelers were a 2-point road favorite. We now see them listed as a 2-point road underdog. You talked about the quarterback change there, but I'm pretty sure it's not all just Kenny Pickett to Mitchell Trubisky being a 4-point downgrade.
No, I mean, Carolina goes out and has a convincing win on the highway against the Seattle team that people seem to love, and Pittsburgh craps the bed, and I think this partly is a move, but it's also worth understanding the value of points, right? I mean, this is a move that's 4 points through the zero, 4.5 points through the zero. So we're not talking about, you know, through a ton of key numbers. So that's partly the reason for this. On the surface, it looks much larger than it actually is in terms of its value, but it is. Part of its quarterback, and part of its the opposing results that we've seen transpire in the last week.
Impacts that teaser window a lot more than it does any of the decision making that'll go in from a straight bet perspective. But you mentioned key numbers, and a perfect segue there into the Bengals and Bucks, where the Bengals were a 2-point road favorite headed out on the road to Raymond James Stadium to take on the Bucks. We see the Cincinnati Bengals hold serve and win and cover against the Cleveland Browns. We talked about some of the Tampa Bay Buccaneers struggles against the 49ers, and here we are now with the Bengals having moved through the key number of 3 out to a 3.5-point road favorite.
Chris is high as 4 right now. So it'll be interesting to see where the stop point is on this one. We'll have to monitor some injury situations as well. I think signs are pointing to T. Higgins potentially going for this one, but I would think at some point there's a number that would intrigue sophisticated bettors back in the Buccaneers at home, but we'll see what number that ultimately becomes.
You mentioned the good doc earlier, not wanting to steal his thunder. I want to encourage everyone to follow Deepak Chopra on Twitter at SportMDAnalysis. He's joined us every Monday throughout the course of the season to break down some of the most impactful injuries, not just at the skill positions, but across the board in terms of what it'll do to the betting number, what it'll do to some of your favorite players' availability, and as you inch ever so close to the fantasy playoffs, some of those lineup adjustments you'll need to make.
Are you injured or are you hurt?
When injuries occur in the NFL, you need someone to call on.
If you hurt, you can still play. If you're injured, you can't.
Let's check in with Dr. Deepak Chopra. Stanford and Harvard-trained orthopedic sports surgeon and founder of SportsMed Analytics, the industry leader in data-driven injury analysis.
So are you hurt or are you injured?
All right, thank you all very much. Lots to talk about on today's injury report, so we will dive right in. Starting with Deebo Samuel. Now, the video was concerning for a high ankle sprain. It looked at least like a moderate severity injury, and that would mean an average timeline of 3 to 4 weeks. Now, the early optimism from the Niners actually suggests a milder injury, but even if that's the case, these are usually still looking at about 2 games out at least. MRI this week should tell the full story. Then we have Russell Wilson. Concussions recently have been averaging just over 1 week for clearance. Wilson has an outside shot to play week 15, but the more likely outcome is missing one game and returning the following week. Quarterbacks don't tend to see any performance impact upon return from concussion. And then Tyler Huntley, also dealing with concussion, again, most likely one game missed with return at near full levels the following week. And then another quarterback in concussion protocol, Kenny Pickett. Now, keep in mind, however, that Pickett was also in concussion protocol just 2 months ago, so there is some chance that his recovery could take a little longer than average. And then we have Damian Pierce. Now, he tried to come back. He was not able to play on his ankle. The taping pattern plus being seen in a boot afterwards suggests a low ankle sprain, and most of these would be played through by running backs after 1 week to heal up. So they do elevate re-injury risk, but don't usually cause much performance impact, so decent chance of playing with week 15. Then we have T. Higgins, likely dealing with a mild hamstring strain. Sounds like he was almost able to play this week, but it would have been with a high re-injury risk, so the coaches shut him down. We would expect Higgins to be available for next week, but we'll be checking his practice reports to make sure. And then his teammate, Tyler Boyd. Now, the comments suggest a finger dislocation without any fracture, and in that case, they would have a solid chance to return next week or the week after. There's a subset of these that get surgery, but that would be a much less common outcome here for Tyler Boyd. And then Mike White. Now, really impressive, tough showing from White. Likely has two rib fractures. He's being tested also for internal injuries. Assuming further testing is negative, these are all about pain control, but they hurt immensely. The most common outcome would actually be 1 to 2 games missed. I know White played through this, and we'd look for him to try to play through this again next week with the help of a numbing injection, but most players would miss at least one game. And then his teammate, Corey Davis, left with a head injury. It would take most commonly just over a week to clear. Week 15 is not out of the picture, also not likely though. Wide receivers don't see any performance impact when they return. And then Lamar Jackson. Now the average timeline takes 2 to 4 weeks. Their initial comments suggested it was on the milder end of the spectrum for Lamar. So we would anticipate his return week 15 or 16, with 16 being a bit more likely. If he's playing before week 16, we would expect a mild decrease in his rushing attempts. Then Kenneth Walker. Now, most low ankle issues cause 0 or 1 missed games for running backs. He, of course, missed week 14 and has potential to return week 15 pending his practice progression. And then J.K. Dobbins. Really encouraging to see him back out there and playing really well. He did have that one breakaway run where in previous years it looked like J.K. Dobbins would be taking that to the house, but he was caught from behind by Minkah Fitzpatrick. I would expect you to see a progressive ramp up in his touches and also his explosiveness, which you may see on plays like that. He started well already, likely to have some strong finishes to end this year. And then Treylon Burks. The most statistically likely outcome for Treylon Burks after missing week 14 with a concussion is a return at week 15 at full production levels. And then last but not least, Courtland Sutton. The average hamstring takes wide receivers 3 weeks to return. He has an outside shot to play week 15, which would be 2 weeks, but the statistically most likely outcome is, however, a week 16 return at 90% production levels. And that's all for now. I'll turn it back to y'all.
I felt like this week's injury breakdowns pain weren't nearly as extensive as what we've had in the past. I'm not sure if players were able to stay healthy, or maybe it was because it was some of the secondary skill position players and quarterbacks that were hurt that we didn't need to spend nearly as much time on it as we normally do.
It felt like a lot of the injuries were concussion-based, and so those are always up in the air. And now that you have short weeks, it makes things a little bit dicier. And specific to T. Higgins, was a guy that was trying to play but just couldn't quite make it this week. And so my guess is he'll be able to be out there for the Buccaneers. So it's a little interesting, right? And then obviously, you know, the Lamar Jackson situation is touch and go. Hopefully he's back for the week 16 contest and we can get that playoff future cashed.
Yeah, a little bit of work to do, some heavy lifting, but fortunately Baltimore gets the win against the Steelers to create a little bit of breathing room. We know the Bengals breathing down their neck, and the AFC playoff picture continues to tighten up, and largely because the team that we're going to see on full display on Monday night still, at least on the surface, controls its own destiny, but they have an extremely daunting road ahead of them if they're going to punch a ticket to their postseason, and it begins tonight with the New England Patriots, a two-point road favorite as they head out to the desert to take on the Arizona Cardinals. Total on this game sits at 44. This number has seen some modest movement since we jumped on the air a little bit earlier. And when you look at the Cardinals, they've lost 10 of their last 11 games that they've played at State Farm, 11 of their last 12 games that have had that home team designation, if you include the trip to Mexico City as well. This is a franchise 8-15 in their past 23 games since starting 7-0 last season, includes the playoff loss to the Rams. Kyler Murray just 4-12 in his past 16 starts, including the playoffs. It's a good thing that Steve Keim and the Arizona front office decided to give him a lifetime contract. Clearly, that's paying dividends so far. When you look at these two teams, Payne, obviously you talked about the coaching mismatch we saw on full display between San Francisco and Tampa. Can we make the case that this is the next most significant coaching mismatch with Bill Belichick and everything he's been able to accomplish in his illustrious career matched up against Cliff Kingsbury? Or is some of that coaching mismatch neutralized knowing that Bill Belichick didn't have the foresight to take the play calling responsibilities away from Matt Patricia?
Well, I think one of our loyal listeners pinpointed that Andy Reid against Nathaniel Hackett might have been the largest. And he might not be wrong, although when you look at that game in its totality, it certainly didn't play out that way as Denver kind of battled back and lost its quarterback and gave up a score to the Chiefs defense. So it still didn't meet expectations. So this one potentially has some imbalance to it. And I think when you look at the Cardinals coming off their bye, you're like, maybe this could be a little bit of a fight, but you get the Patriots off a mini bye. So Arizona's bye, in my mind, gets negated a little bit. I will say this, you know, we've broken down the Cardinals here multiple times this season. I believe we've broken down Patriots games three in a row. So a lot of this will not sound new. So I don't know if there's a ton of reason to beat a dead horse. But when I look at this, and specifically you mentioned the change that didn't happen at offensive coordinator for the Patriots, I don't think anything's going to happen at this point in the season. And I think when you look at why Matt Patricia was brought on, it was doing a buddy a favor, keeping it within the family, but he certainly wasn't going to, when I say he, Belichick, bump his son from the position on the defensive side. So this is really the only place he could stick Patricia. But I think in this matchup, a lot of the things they've been doing that's been bad might not necessarily be bad in this spot, right? You're going to want to use all of the crossers and the dig routes over the middle. That should absolutely work against the Cardinals. Stevenson is going to be the guy that everyone hears about because Harris is dinged up, looking doubtful for this game. But Stevenson out of the backfield, getting him on those linebackers. Hunter Henry also attacking the Cardinals linebackers, which we've talked about anytime we break down a Cards game. If you look at Hunter Henry, he's still dominating the tight end snaps. I know Sanu's taking some money in the prop market, but if you look at Hunter Henry, he's had 10 targets the last two games. With Myers out, I think Hunter Henry becomes the focal point for the Patriots offense, especially over the middle. Get him on some of those really poor Cardinals linebackers. They just don't know which way they're going. When they know where they're going, you can see the athleticism, you can see the talent, but they just constantly get lost. Other thing worth mentioning here is when you look at the Patriots offense and you look at Mac Jones specifically, when they face defenses of this class and caliber, they've performed pretty well. And you just go back to that Thanksgiving game we broke down against Minnesota. That's a team that plays gobs of zone. Arizona plays gobs of zone as well. Arizona plays zone at the fifth highest rate. Now you have your lead corner in Byron Murphy out. Mac Jones and this Patriots offense has done pretty well against zone. And so I think there's going to be some opportunity for the Patriots offense tonight, especially if they focus on getting Hunter Henry the ball and creating some matchup nightmares against those linebackers for Arizona.
Yeah, I mean, the one concern you've had with New England over the last couple of weeks is an offensive line that's largely been unsettled. Now, Arizona can generate a little bit of a pass rush when you look at their blitz rate, so it'll be interesting to see how quickly Mac Jones gets the ball out of his hand, as that's been an area where he struggled. And over the last 15 games, Mac Jones, just 16 touchdowns and 16 turnovers, but over the last couple of weeks, we've seen him be a little bit better and more judicious getting the football out of his hand, taking advantage there. On the other side,
it's a defense that Belichick knows semi-well, right? Vance Joseph was in Miami for a little bit, and so there's some interesting matchup stuff there.
Yeah, it's, I mean, so many interesting factors in play there, and you mentioned, you know, familiarity. The one thing we've grown familiar with from New England on the defensive side of the ball is that they've struggled with mobile quarterbacks. I mean, the track record continues to get longer and longer here, and New England, it's been real fascinating when you look at their season in a nutshell, allowing only 312 yards per game and 18.8 points per contest, which ranks seventh in the league, but in the six games the Patriots have won, they've allowed an average of 8.7 points per game, never allowing more than 17 points in any of those spots. In their six losses, a very different story has developed, allowing an average of 29 points per game, giving up more than 20 in each loss. I'm not going to oversimplify the handicap and say that 17 is the magic number in this particular spot, but obviously New England has to figure out a way to neutralize Kyler Murray's legs. You've seen Jonathan Jones, a good cover corner, but not necessarily built to take care of athletic, taller, lengthy, physical players on the outside, which could pose a matchup for DeAndre Hopkins. But at the same time, I'm not sure Arizona can provide a balanced attack. I don't see a path for them establishing James Conner. And if that's the case, you put the burden all on Kyler Murray. I have to think New England can disguise some things at the back and make life a little bit more difficult for him.
Yeah, this side of the ball is certainly the intriguing part of the matchup, because if you've listened to us talk over the last couple of weeks, like, New England's defense right now, third in schedule adjusted efficiency, we don't think it's that good. Now, they've played some tough offenses. I wouldn't necessarily classify Arizona being ranked 29th in offensive efficiency as a tough one, but you did mention some of the abilities that Kyler has with his mobility and the troubles that that has given the New England defense. Now, they don't really run it like Justin Fields. And I think the other thing that's really worth mentioning here is now the Cardinals down four of their five planned O-line starters. They're gone. And you're facing a New England defense that's second in pressure rate. So maybe that's how they contain Kyler. And you think about Murray and his mobility and what you're suggesting about some of those struggles, you would think a quarterback like that is good under pressure. But Murray has actually been one of the worst quarterbacks this season with the heat on. 33 passer rating under pressure, 53% adjusted accuracy. And what's even worse is one thing that we outline all the time is you have to make defenses pay when they send blitz. You have to be able to attack the attacker. And it's been the inverse for Kyler Murray. He's actually shriveled when the pressure comes, literally and figuratively. You see him kind of just drop to the ground when pressure comes. He doesn't want to take the hit, which
he's
is
a little guy, Payne. I don't want to take the hit either.
But under pressure, zero big-time throws, 12 turnover-worthy throws. So Kyler Murray has been one of the worst quarterbacks when pressure hits. And again, you're down four starting offensive linemen from your projection going up against a defense that's number two in pressure rate. And we know Belichick will at least come up with something and devise some stunts and some sim pressures and some blitzes that are a little bit sophisticated that might give this O-line a little bit of trouble. Obviously, Hopkins and Brown together for the first time where both are at close to 100%. I know Brown wasn't quite 100% in the last time they played, so that's a big get back. And then you would think if pressure is going to be an issue, you're going to have Greg Dortch kind of taking that slot role. And that's really where Arizona has been the best offensively, is using its receivers and attacking the slot areas. So sometimes New England can be a little bit vulnerable there when they play a certain set of linebackers that aren't the best in coverage, but there really aren't any paths here where, at least on paper, you're saying to yourself, hey, this is a great matchup where Kyler Murray and Cliff Kingsbury are going to be able to attack the Patriots defense. Obviously, if Kyler goes out there and has an electric game that we know he's at least capable of having if he wants to have it, you just wonder at this point when you get paid, you're at four wins, your season's virtually done, if this is going to be a game where Kyler extends himself, where we've seen, you know, Justin Fields just willingly take off. I don't know if that's what he's going to want to do in this game, and certainly I would think he's going to have a decent amount of pressure on him tonight.
Real curious to see where this number goes as we get closer to kickoff, as the number is on the move first thing on a Monday morning, inching ever so close towards that key number of 3. You can follow Payne on Twitter at Payne Insider. I'm Todd Furman. You can follow me there. Most importantly, as always, follow the podcast at BetTheBoardPod. Payne, anything else you'd like to share with our loyal listenership before we close up shop here and put a bow on all things Week 14?
No. Back on Thursday with the NFL podcast, couple Saturday games that are intriguing. So that's interesting to get into the fold now, is that we got some Saturday games. Is that going to be allowed in your book? I know Saturday is reserved for college football, but
yeah, I know it's going to be
the real sports taking things over.
Going to be a little bit of a unique pivot. I mean, we do have a full slate of not even second or third tier college football bowl games, so those might have to be featured on the big screen with sound. But I texted you on Saturday. I said I went through a little bit of withdrawal as I was streaming World Cup games as walking around the Georgia Aquarium with my family for a quick 36-hour trip out of lovely Las Vegas back in the home office on Sunday, and not a moment too soon to reap the benefits of a very good NFL week for us. So take advantage of that. Hope we can capitalize on the momentum and continue to carry that forward into the twilight of the regular season on into the postseason. So best of luck for all of you, our loyal listeners. Thanks as always for tuning into the show. Thanks to Deepak Shona as well. You can remember, you can follow Deepak on Twitter at SportMDAnalysis. And regardless of where your investments take you on Monday Night Football between the Cardinals and Patriots, hopefully we'll see you at the window.
Thanks for listening to Bet the Board.
You can catch Todd and Payne every Monday, Wednesday, and Thursday during football season, breaking down the biggest NFL and college football games. And to make sure you don't miss any free best bets, subscribe to Bet the Board on iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts.